This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier this month, Google announced that the security of some of its Gmail accounts had been breached by a sophisticated cyber attack originating from mainland China. That didn't surprise our next guests, Joseph Men and Barrett Lyon. They've argued for years that increasingly organized bands of hackers are a threat to everyone who uses the internet, from individual consumers to banks and credit card companies to the U.S. government. Joseph Men is a journalist who covers cybersecurity and other technology issues for the Financial Times. His new book, Fatal System Error, is a look at the hacker underworld, where cybercriminals in the former Soviet bloc and elsewhere commit extortion, fraud, identity theft, and even politically motivated attacks on the websites of governments and dissidents. Barrett Lyon is a computer ace who spent much of his young career defending companies from cyber attacks and helping law enforcement find and prosecute cyber criminals. He's currently the CEO of a company called 3Crowd Technologies. Joseph Men and Barrett Lyon spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Joseph Men, Barrett Lyon, welcome to Fresh Air. Barrett, I'd like to start with you and have you tell us a bit about some of the work that you did helping these online gambling companies, folks that run sites where people can wage bets, which are, and these, of course, are companies located offshore in places like Costa Rica. And they were, in effect, extorted by cyber criminals. First of all, how did these cyber attacks work?
Well, I began working with these guys in Las Vegas with a company that specializes in operating the information for sports betting. And they were being extorted, they were being shut down, and when they're down, sports betting around the world stops. So I spent several weeks in Las Vegas dealing with these guys, and it turns out that they were being extorted by basically these unknown people on the internet that had taken an army or a huge group of computers to flood their website. So it's pretty much the equivalent of owning a restaurant and having 100,000 people show up to your restaurant and buy nothing. So the site just stops running, everything stops working, and your internet business is no longer a business.
Right. Now, and of course, the critical question there is, how does one of these miscreants, these cyber criminals, get control of thousands of computers to simultaneously try to log onto your website and thus overload it?
There's unlimited ways to do it. These guys have these very sophisticated and amazing softwares that basically can hunt down computers on the internet that have real common holes in them and then remotely install software that allows them to control those computers.
Right. And the term for someone whose computer has been – a computer that's been taken over by an external operator is a bot, as in robot, right?
Yeah. They're basically a bot. They're kind of a tool for your your whims.
Right. And just to make this clear, this could be many listeners in our audience, for example, who might have been happily using their computers for months, not knowing that somebody somewhere, maybe in Ukraine, has had some program, has gotten into their computer and is actually, without them knowing it, using their computer to flood some internet somewhere, site somewhere, as part of an extortion effort.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly how it works. And it's not necessarily like the person in Estonia is logged into your computer and running it physically. Your computer has a little piece of software that links into another location that kind of aggregates them all together so you can send commands in a mob or in a mass and say, basically broadcast a message saying, okay, all your computers go and attack this.
Right. And so then once the cyber criminal has control of thousands of computers, they then contact the internet gambling company and say what?
Well, generally speaking, you'd get an email in your mailbox that says, hi, hope you're having a good day. by the way, I'm going to take your business down if you don't give me $100,000 or $20,000. Do it now and talk to you soon. It's nothing that you'd expect. It doesn't come across incredibly serious at the beginning.
But in fact, it happens, right?
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, and it started happening, I think, around 2004. It, turned into an epidemic. And it wasn't just the gambling guys. It was pretty much anything that's online that has any criticality. So we're talking about banks, foreign exchange trading companies, anybody that has some sort of time, essence, and money attached to their website.
Right. Now, the reason that you're in this book is that you made an avocation and then a profession out of defending companies from these massive attacks, denial of service attacks in which they would be flooded by thousands of robotically controlled computers. How do you defend a company from that kind of a flood of input and that shuts it down?
Well, when I was pretty young and running some services online that were constantly being brutalized by attacks, not because of extortion, but the services on there kind of created this thuggery online, and one person's ego would kind of attack the other person's ego, and as a result, whoever's computer was associated to that was getting kind of demolished. And, I was running a small business at the time, and I needed to figure out techniques to kind of filter it, to make the service more stable and, less of a, more of a fortress. And as a result, I started writing papers and presenting and coming up with methodologies to protect services on the internet from these types of attacks. But, eventually real businesses started being attacked. And the same things that applied to my small little experiment online ended up working for large companies.
So you would get a panicked call from somebody who says, I've got 24 hours to either pay somebody $50,000 or they're going to shut down my website. I can't let that happen. Barrett, help me. What do you do?
Well, at the beginning, it was more like I got on a plane and showed up at somebody's office and started helping them and helping their engineers fix their network. Later on, when we became a business, I built a infrastructure that had more capacity and basically a bigger weapon than they had that could absorb it. So it was like a heat sink. And the attack would come to me, and then we'd clean it, and the result was good filtered traffic, and that would go back to the computers that operated that site. So we basically became like a firewall in the internet for these companies. But over time, it evolved from, okay, let's protect these businesses to let's figure out who this is and make it stop. And let's make them suffer as much as we suffered and our clients are suffering. And that's where it really got personal.
Joseph Mann, how big a problem is this, these coordinated denial of service attacks?
Well, the denial of service attacks were a very big problem going back years. And then the same bad guys that were – those are one of the obvious things to do with an army of bots. Sending spam was another one, and it still is. But the same bad guys have gone on to do other things. Now denial of service attacks are important again, I would say, not still but again in the political arena. They're used – a lot in sort of modern cyber warfare.
Late in your book, Joseph Mann, there was an astonishing statistic presented, attributed to Admiral Dennis Blair, who was testifying before Congress, estimating that by the end of 2009, which has already passed, of course, 15% of all online computers would become robots, become bots, become externally controlled. Is that true? Is that credible?
It's certainly credible. We'll never know exactly. The problem is that most people whose computers have become bots don't know it, or they'd shoot it in the head and get another computer. You might not notice any change in your computer, or it might just be slower. You don't really know whether you have your computer as a bot or not.
Barrett Lyon.
I was going to say, another major issue is there's huge sections of the world that pirate their operating systems. And as a result, they don't get the patches that they need, and they don't really get the attention that they need to kind of clean their computers or protect them. So, that percentage of the world has grown quite a bit. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that number larger.
It's kind of a trade-off. The pirated machines in the third world are more likely to become infected. But on the other hand, in places like the U.S. or South Korea, where you've got greater bandwidth, they're more desirable computers because they can do more damage.
And just to be clear, when you say pirated, you mean that they have gotten software that's not really from the manufacturer. It's a copy of a copy and is thus more vulnerable to penetration?
Well, it's not that they're more vulnerable on the face. The problem is that they tend not to get the updates that will protect them from various new vulnerabilities.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know, so many of these cyber criminals and hackers are very young, and many got started as teenagers, kind of making, I guess, you know, kind of the equivalent of crank phone calls, really, only a lot more destructive, just discovering what kind of damage they could do by writing software. Barrett, when you were a kid as a teenager, you got into a little bit of mischief yourself, didn't you?
Yeah. You know, it was interesting because the internet wasn't really, well, to me at that time, it wasn't real. And, I mean, we were just going from BBSs to where we were dialing into people's computers to dialing into one computer and having access to many. And before we were using the internet, we were playing games like Trade Wars and these old school text games, and none of it really felt real. So, you know, when you first get online and you're a kid and your parents and everybody around you has no idea what this internet thing is, including yourself, you can get yourself in trouble.
Well, tell us about the experience with the AOL site.
There may be people listening to this that have no idea that this happened. But, yeah, I figured out a tricky way of deleting domain names. And as a test, I compiled a list of domains that popped into my head, and AOL was one of them, and it was deleted. didn't really think that would become an issue until it became news.
Well, like, it shut down the AOL site for 3 days, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's people I work with now that had to deal with that, and they probably don't know. But I forget how old I was. I must have been 13 or something like that. So I had no idea what would actually happen, and if I could have done something differently, I would have. But I think it had a rather adverse effect on AOL.
Right, and I realize this isn't the proudest moment of your life, but it is revealed in the book. And the other fascinating thing is that when you're there at age 13, the FBI started tracking this down and found their way to your parents' door.
Yeah, I think that's about how it went. I wasn't there, so I don't remember exactly what happened, but I've always wanted to pull my FBI file just to see what's in there, because it's got to be kind of interesting.
Sure, and I think in fairness, we have to tell the audience that you have since spent many, many years, both professionally and in a volunteer way, helping people fight cybercrime. So, you know, that adolescent indiscretion had an impact, but it's you've certainly kind of behaved in a different way since then. You became very good at protecting companies from these denial of service attacks where, you know, thousands of robotically controlled computers would attack somebody's website. But eventually you decided you had to track these guys down, I mean, who were there in the great anonymous forest of the internet. How'd you do it?
Well, I mean, like I said, when these guys continuously attacked us, constantly, nonstop, you get to the point where you're just fed up with it. And some of the attacks started looking similar to each other, to the point where we actually, just by looking at the signatures of the attack, we could tell that it was one group or another, and it was kind of triggered based on one extortion attempt or another. And the largest and most difficult ones we wanted to shut down. So eventually we started looking. I mean, it's kind of just obvious to me, which is, look, if you have 100,000 computers coming after you, and those 100,000 computers had a hole or they were compromised somehow, then you could use the same hole and learn who and how these computers are being controlled.
And when you say a hole, you mean what?
You know, somebody didn't patch their computer and left a known exploitable back door, you know, that's just sitting there on their computer. Now, we didn't necessarily have to even go that far. Microsoft did us a huge favor. They left and enabled this simple protocol called SNMP, or Simple Network Management Protocol. And SNMP was a tool that you can use to look inside the brain of a computer remotely. And it's completely passive, and it's not something that requires you to hack their computer. It's just turned on with public interface, like public access. So out of the 100,000 computers that were attacking us, we figured at least one of them had that turned on and enabled. And so we scanned through them, and sure enough, one was. And then we could look at who that computer was communicating to. And that led us back to kind of their controller server. So when we started getting onto these control servers, there they were. The bad guys were in there chatting with each other in Russian.
Wow.
And that's where the story kind of begins.
As you began tracking down these cyber criminals through the internet and discovered that, in fact, they were, you know, from the former Soviet republics and Russia, how did you overcome the language issues, or was that an issue?
Well, they predominantly speak English, but Google has a great translator. So we cut and paste the Cyrillic or their, you know, writings that we couldn't read and tried to figure out what it was and what language it was. And for the most part, we ended up getting cuss words back. So it wasn't necessarily that useful, but most of the guys spoke English because it was a common way to, you know, keep in mind, they're not all just in Russia. There's guys in China and all over the planet. And if you can have one common language, it ended up being English.
Right. So the lingua franca of the computer world is English, in effect, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And so one of the things I guess you, Barrett, did was to, once you had access to these kind of these computer communities of criminals offering stolen goods and exchanging services, you could get in and pretend to be one of them and gradually find out more about who they are.
Yeah, so one of the guys I was working with, his name was Dayton Turner. We used his nickname and went into, as a kind of, it was almost a group of us that were dealing with this, started chatting to each other about what to say to these bad guys. And eventually it became like this effort where we were just talking to them all the time. And eventually they got comfortable enough with us to where we started talking with them through AIM, AOL Instant Messenger. Well, actually, no. Back then it was ICQ, which I don't think many people use these days. But through ICQ, they gave me a user ID, and we started using it to chat with them and found out, you know, what kind of pizza they like. We have this ridiculous amount of information on these guys. We still didn't know. We knew what the guy's first name was, and we had no idea where they were other than Russia. And we really didn't have, a good grasp on the guys themselves. We knew what his nickname was. It was EXE, or E-X-E, which stands for executable, I thought. But it actually stood for extremist. So I set up some logging systems on the more public internet relay chat servers. These are the ones that, there's hundreds of thousands of people in, and it's a real common place for techies to kind of go and communicate. And so I took his nicknames, and I just remember adding some kind of triggered words or triggered monitor things that if he logged into this larger community with his nickname, it would just alert me and record where he logged in from. And I forgot I did it, and about a week later, I got this little alert. The guy logged in, and he logged in using a vanity domain name, which is a domain that you would purchase to just kind of look cool on the internet. So I think it was security-systems.cc. And then when you looked up the registration records for security-systems.cc, it was his name, address, phone number, and everything about the guy.
Wow.
And we had him.
Joseph Mann, a lot of your book is about these efforts to hunt down and bring to justice these cyber thugs who were operating in these former Soviet republics and in Russia too, operating thousands and thousands of computers and running scams and extortion plots and stealing credit cards. Tell us about one of these one of these cyber criminals? Just give us a little bit of a sense of who they are, where they operated.
Well, if I had to pick one, it would probably be EXE, Ivan, is the one we know the most about. But, you know, he's a kid. And Ivan was the guy that actually did the work, and he lived with his parents in a not very nice town and a not very nice house. And he's, like Barrett, self-taught computer whiz. And he had a relay chat room going, and he needed a bot to keep it going. So he learned a little bit about how to write bot code, and he just learned to do it. And he met somebody else and online, these chat rooms, and they started talking about how they were assembling a self-breeding bot that would take over more computers. And it was just they offered to hire him, and he made very little money doing it.
And so he was how old when he was arrested?
I'd want to say 23, okay. 24.
Yeah, I think 23, somewhere in there.
A lot of these are really young people, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was only maybe a year or two older than him. And
some of the big bosses were even younger.
Yeah.
The really scary guys that are above the guys that are above the guys, like Ivan, also early 20s.
You describe these enormous investigative efforts to track down these cyber criminals who were in various of the former Soviet republics and in Russia. And in some cases, people were arrested. In some cases, there were trials. But it was striking how little real punishment was inflicted, you know, despite these guys committing really big crimes and threatening a lot of international commerce. Why was it so hard to bring these folks to real justice?
Because this isn't really about street crime. This isn't really about criminals. This is a matter of geopolitical struggle right now. And these people are very useful. If you are a government and you have some citizens that know how to get into other people's bank accounts, that can get into other people's websites, and that have thousands upon thousands of computers that could be used, you know, at your whim, that's a pretty handy set of skills and resources to have. And the former Soviet Union, it cares about that stuff, and Russia in particular cares about that stuff, and Russia has found some of these same crime lords to be very useful in political disputes.
Well, like what? Like how? How are they?
Like the attacks that shut down government websites in Estonia, and government and media websites in Georgia, and mysteriously their denial of service attacks used against people like Garry Kasparov, internal dissidents in Russia. And mainstream Russian media sites, they happen to run an interview with an exiled oligarch that is out of favor with the Kremlin. Mysteriously, their website goes down due to a denial of service attack.
So you're saying that the Russian government, with dissidents and international rivals and political opponents, will either orchestrate or cooperate with these cyber criminals to do one of these massive denial of service attacks and flood a website and shut down someone else's operation?
That's exactly what I'm saying. It's something that's been suspected by a lot of really good researchers that have worked really hard to make the case, and it's always been circumstantial. But it's clear what's going on here, and these people are protected by the Russian government, and they're used by the Russian government against their enemies, foreign and domestic.
If you're just joining us, our guests are technology writer Joseph Menn, who's just written a book called Fatal System Error: The Hunt for the New Crime Lords Who Are Bringing Down the Internet. Also with us is Barrett Lyon. He is a self-taught and self-motivated cybercrime fighter who has worked with law enforcement and companies to defeat cybercrime attacks and bring cyber criminals to justice. Well, Joseph Menn, there's been a lot of attention recently about cyber attacks that appear to be coming from China and may or may not be connected to the Chinese government. What's your view of what's going on there?
Well, first of all, they are connected to the Chinese government. Even Google surprisingly made that, you know, as clear as they could. Google escalated. Google complained publicly about the hacking earlier this month. They went after not just human rights activists and dissidents within China trying to get into their Google mail accounts, but also after some of Google's proprietary software. And Google took it to the next level and said, stop censoring our results within China or we'll leave. And obviously that's something that only the government can decide. So that without saying it explicitly, Google is saying that the Chinese government is behind the hacking. And I can tell you, it's also in the book, yes, the Chinese government is behind the hacking.
And what are the potential consequences here? I mean, what havoc or mischief might the Chinese government, you know, work with this ability?
Well, I think this is kind of a watershed moment. The China one is a really big one. Basically, what you have is organized crime in Russia that is going after your bank account, my bank account, and lots of other things, basically about money and protected by the Russian government because they're used in quasi-military operations. In China, you have the government supporting a massive effort to steal commercial secrets and military secrets in the U.S. And what the sophistication of the hacks against Google and others shows is that there's an awful lot invested in this, and they already have an enormous amount. And they see cyberspace as a way to catch up to the U.S. in terms of military domination.
So what could they do? Could they take down the American electric grid, steal our military secrets? Yes?
Absolutely. They have our military secrets, and they could shut down the electric grid. And if you do that for long enough, then you're talking about Stone Age conditions.
We're just about out of time. But, you know, Joseph Mann, I have to ask you, you know, I don't want to be too apocalyptic here, but, you know, the 9/11 attacks completely changed our view of so many things about air travel and the relationship between civil liberties and security. And I wonder if the internet seems so vulnerable and the criminals seem so sophisticated and the political obstacles to action seem so great, do you think we're headed for some sort of cyber catastrophe that will change the way we look at these issues?
It may well be, and it may be an act of war or an act of terrorism because we didn't talk about it, but the terrorists are also pretty interested in this stuff. It's really handy. But it is more likely that it'll be, I think, dribs and drabs. I mean, the reason that people aren't rising up in arms about this now is that, in general, your credit card covers you if something bad happens. And it sort of gradually gets passed along to the merchants, usually, who charge more, and so it's sort of generally absorbed by society. But it's if you believe Barack Obama, it's a $1 trillion drain on society every year. It's just an insane amount of money. And our economy doesn't really need that kind of drain. So I think it's more likely that there'd be sort of a gradual lessening of faith in online commerce. And that's kind of too bad because online commerce is one of the things that's really helping the economy recover.
Barrett Lyon, you want to add your thoughts here before we end?
Yeah, I think my view of security is just I give up. I'm so frustrated with it that the industry itself has become very, very paranoid, which isn't a great way to be able to interact with the internet. You don't want to be paranoid.
When you say the industry, you mean what?
Oh, just the security industry alone is just it's not a place that's conducive to openness and thought sharing and things like that, which is what the internet originally was all about. The other thing is security was an afterthought for the internet. It's all duct tape. It's things that were added to the on top of the protocols that are at the base of it, and they weren't, the internet just wasn't generally built for this purpose. And I guess the frustrating part is, if we can build this fantastic, amazingly scalable communications network, can't we sit back and go, okay, well, that works really well. What doesn't work well? Well, we can point at that. And how come we can't take the time to sit back and do it right? And why can't we look at it and go, well, it's software. We can do anything with it. That's the frustrating part.
Well, Joseph Mann, Barrett Lyon, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Joseph Mann is the author of the new book, Fatal System Error. Barrett Lyon has defended businesses against computer attacks and investigated cyber criminals. The Magnetic Fields is the band created by the songwriter, singer, and multi-instrumentalist Stephen Merritt, and a shifting group of collaborators that includes Daniel Handler, the author of the Lemony Snicket books. The new Magnetic Fields album is called Realism, and rock critic Ken Tucker says its music may sound whimsical, but it lives up to its title.
Master of the cutting understatement, as well as the elegant overstatement. He's highly prolific, at least 17 albums under various group names since 1991, one of them the collection of 69 love songs entitled 69 Love Songs. His vocals tend toward the deadpan tuneless, but he writes lovely melodies with a sting. Take this oh-so-pleasant-sounding composition called You Must Be Out of Your Mind. Listen beneath the pleasant acoustic instruments to hear a tartly sarcastic, gravely judgmental song.
You think I'll run that walk to you? Why would I want to talk to you? I want you crawling back to me.
Compare a hope-for reconciliation to, quote, an appendectomy sans anesthesia, and to assert a bit later in that song, I no longer drink enough to think you're witty. Well, we can see the sort of realism Stephen Merritt is going for on this album, Realism. In another song, Seduced and Abandoned, Merritt assumes the guise of a woman who has been left with her newborn child by a dastardly cad, and she meditates morosely on her future.
Seduced and abandoned and baby mixed too. Baby abandoned by you. Seduced and abandoned and what can I do? I think I might drink a few. Seduced with a grin, I was taken all in, taken in sin and in shame. Seduced by a smile, I walked down the aisle, then waited a while, no one came.
Seduced. This album is meant to be a contrasting companion piece to the Magnetic Field's previous release, Distortion. That album exploded with fierce, squalling guitar feedback in which Merritt's vocals came off like menacing growls, and once again sang lyrics that were frequently at ironic odds with the music. He's gone in the opposite direction on Realism. Nothing could be further from Distortion's jangling power chords than the toy piano of The Doll's Tea Party.
At the Doll's Tea Party we fritter away the long afternoon of a warm summer day, with extended pinkies and pink cloisonne, cups and saucers and pots and a liberty tray. That's why we take our tea at the Doll's Tea Party. At the Doll's Tea Party, we twitter along.
The Doll's Tea Party, with a lead vocal by Claudia Gonson, is one of the few pop songs in this new decade that uses the word Twitter in something other than its social networking sense. The dolls twitter merrily, making what seems like innocuous conversation. Merritt can be cutesy and cloying. That song certainly comes close. But then he comes up with the perfect use of his broad taste and essentially bohemian worldview in a song such as this rousing musical manifesto called The Dada Polka. Do something, anything, Stephen Merritt sings here. Do something true. Certainly Merritt follows his own advice. He said that he likes short songs. Quote, I don't go for big statements in general. Sometimes, however, small gestures, small creations, when gathered together, combine to form a statement bigger than their creator may have intended. Or in the case of Merritt, a self-conscious artist in the best sense, he knows that the accretion of detail over the course of these 13 songs has resulted in a realism that is vivid, hard-headed, and never half-hearted. He does something true.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the new album by the Magnetic Fields called Realism.
In summer when the moon is full, the wolf boy is adorable, adorable.
The tale of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland has fascinated readers ever since its publication in 1865, but a new novel explores the possibility that the charms of Lewis Carroll's classic may have eventually faded for the real-life Alice. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Melanie Benjamin's new novel based on the life of a young muse called Alice I Have Been.
Like most preteen heroines of classic children's literature, Alice, of Alice in Wonderland, of course, is a mistress of misrule, bossy, resourceful, and a bit of a tomboy. Despite that perfectly starched getup of pinafore and pantalettes capped off by blonde curls, Alice chafes against convention. That's why she fits in just fine in the psychedelic netherworld of Wonderland, and also why she's been beloved ever after by restless girl readers and feminist scholars. No wonder that the first words that Alice utters in the opening lines of Melanie Benjamin's haunting new novel about the real Alice, Alice Liddell, are words of soft rebellion. But, oh my dear, I am tired of being Alice in Wonderland. Does it sound ungrateful? It is. Only I do get tired. The year is 1932, and Alice Liddell is 80 years old. She's writing those words in a letter to her son, who implores her to leave her home in England and sail to New York, where Columbia University is eager to bestow upon her an honorary doctorate and a tea party. The occasion is the celebration of the centenary of the birth of Arthur Dodgson, a.k.a. Lewis Carroll, and it really did happen. One certainly can imagine that Alice Liddell felt both tickled by that ongoing attention and trapped, because the tale that gave her and so many generations of readers such anarchic pleasure also paradoxically fixed the real Alice to a fictional identity, one that she could never quite outrun. Melanie Benjamin's novel is called Alice I Have Been, and though it occasionally stumbles into melodrama, most of the time it's a nuanced, moody envisioning of the life of Alice Liddell. Alice, as any Wonderland fan knows, was a daughter of the Dean of Christ Church College at Oxford, where Arthur Dodgson was a stuttering mathematics don. As the origin myth goes, one golden summer afternoon, Dodgson and 10-year-old Alice, along with some companions, went for a boat ride, and he spun out the tale of Alice in Wonderland, which she begged him to write down. There's certainly enough suggestively weird imagery lurking in Alice in Wonderland to give any post-Freudian reader pause. But coupled with the fact that Dodgson, an early photography enthusiast, took pictures of young girls, including a famous one of the 7-year-old Alice, scantily clad as a gypsy waif, Benjamin's rendering of Dodgson as a gentle ancestor of Humbert Humbert seems warranted. In this finely detailed snippet, Alice recalls undressing for that gypsy girl outdoor photo shoot and her dawning awareness of the more mundane dimensions of her own upper-class female helplessness. I took the gypsy dress, held it up to me, then dropped it to the ground. Clutching my own skirt, I fingered the stiff, familiar lace like a good luck charm. Then I realized something very important. I realized I had never before undressed myself. All my buttons were in the back. Every night I obediently turned around and waited for someone to unbutton all of them, help me step out of the billowing fabric, unfasten all my petticoats, again, all of which fastened at my back. Every night, someone did. Unexpectedly, Benjamin's novel becomes even more interesting in its second half, as Alice grows into a young woman struggling to shrug off her Alice mantle, as well as the whispers in Oxford of something untoward in her past relationship with Dodgson, who was indeed banned by Alice's family from seeing her and her sisters a year after that immortal boat ride. Alice I Have Been graces an imagined Alice Liddell with her own voice and story. But what really sets this latest Victorian fictional resurrection apart is its awareness of the demonic dimension of great literature. Powerful stories captivate their readers and sometimes also their muses. As Benjamin vividly depicts here, the young girl who became the muse for one of the most rollicking children's tales of all time may have also become, to some extent, its prisoner, pressed into the looking glass of its fictions.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Alice I Have Been by Melanie Benjamin.